having right now. I talk a lot in my work about the power of owning our stories. I talk about if we own our story, we get to write the ending. And if we don't own our story, the story owns us. And I think in The Gifts of Imperfection, that was the first time in my life personally that I've owned my story, that I wrote about, hey, look, I had this complete breakdown at 41. I fell apart. I was so tired and exhausted from trying to outrun vulnerability and outrun perfectionism that I just fell apart. And in owning that story and being truthful about it for the first time, it changed my life. Up to that point, I had tried to orphan that part of my life and said, you know, and tried to pretend that I wasn't afraid and that I had my shit together all the time. So owning that story gave me the right to pick up the pen and write the ending. If we think about collectively, if we know it's true in our own lives that the stories we own, we get to write the ending, and the stories that we don't own, own us, we can take that micro lesson and apply it in a macro concept, in a community concept. The stories that we don't own collectively own us. We have to own the story in order to write the different ending. And I know it's painful, but it's not as painful as spending our lives running from our story. And our collective story in the United States is a story of white supremacy. That is the story. That's our story. And we have not owned it, so now it owns us. It still owns us, and it defines us, because we have not had the courage to step in and own the story and say, this is the truth about where we come from and what we've done. And I think what's really powerful for me personally is understanding that the pain of owning, the pain and discomfort of owning that story is tiny compared to the pain and discomfort of living out that story. So when we talk about owning a story, and especially a collective story, a historical story, there's three things that come to mind for me. The first is privilege. It's kind of the three P's of owning a collective story in history. It's privilege, perspective taking, and power. And the first is privilege. And I can tell you that having taught race, class, and gender for years and years and years, there is nothing that I talk about that pisses people off more than the topic of privilege. We just recoil when we hear the word, because what people say is, privilege? Are you shitting me, privilege? I was born with nothing. I worked for. I had no privilege. And I get that, and I understand that, but that means you don't understand privilege. Privilege, when it comes to race, is about unearned rights. So let me give you an example. And let me tell you, I'm someone, by the time I was 15, I had worked so much that the Department of Public Safety gave me a hardship license. I've worked since I was 14 years old. I paid my way through college, graduate school. When Steve and I finished residency and when I finished graduate school, we had $210,000 in student loans. Like, I worked my way through. I've never not had a job since I was 14. But I have a lot of unearned privilege. I'm thinking about Peggy McIntosh's article, Unpacking the Invisible Backpack of Privilege. I can walk into any store and find a doll that matches my daughter's skin. I can find a Band-Aid that matches my skin. I can drive any area in Houston and not get pulled over. It was a little dicier before when I was younger and all my, you know, I drove a big, you know, lots of POS cars. But now I have a nice car and I'm white and if I get pulled over, you can be assured it's for a reason. That's unearned privilege. Unearned privilege is what we get that we have not earned. And I can, you know, it's so funny because in every class I've ever taught, we do a privilege exercise where I say, tell me about one area of privilege in your life. And you have to remember, I'm looking at on a class, it's 25% African American, 25% Latino, Latina, Latinx, 25% Anglo, and about 25% Asian American, some people transfer international students. And in the last several years, I've had a signer, an American Sign Language translator in my classes. So we're talking about the real thing. We're talking about what America looks like. When I ask people to do a privilege exercise, there's not one person that can't find privilege. I'll have a straight person say, my privilege is I can go to the movies and hold hands with my partner and not fear getting hit in the head with a baseball bat. I had an African-American student last year that said, maybe it was 2 years ago, that said, I can wear a symbol of my religion and not fear being called a murderer or a terrorist. And she was simply talking about the fact that she wears a cross necklace. I mean, privilege is not about how hard you work. Privilege is about unearned access and authority. And so if we don't acknowledge our privilege, we don't acknowledge the pain of others, and we don't acknowledge what is the truest thing about American democracy, which should be equality. We just don't, we don't acknowledge it. This is the hard thing about Facebook Live, is I'm a pauser, but I'm gonna pause because I wanna think through everything I'm saying, because I feel very emotional. So I wanna make sure I get it right. I'll give you another example of privilege that's really personal. My name, Brené Brown, a lot of you know it. What you don't know is my name is Cassandra Brené Brown. I only know one other Cassandra Brené Brown, and she's African American, and I only know about three other Brenés, all African American. Cassandra Brené Brown is one of the most traditionally African American names you could ever have. I know this because I went to Paul Havens Elementary School in New Orleans growing up, and I was not invited to any of the white kids' birthday parties because the birthday parties were chosen off the homeroom list. I know this because before the era of LinkedIn and Facebook, I've walked into job interviews and literally been told, oh my God, you're Cassandra Brené Brown? What a pleasant surprise. Which is a very quick way to end an interview with me, but that's privilege. And that's real. And it leads me to the second P, which is perspective taking. We all see the world through a lens, and I want you to picture a lens that you look through the world through, or you use to look through the world. And we look through lenses of age, ethnicity, race, ability, and that's how we see the world. And then we slide in a lot of other lenses like insight, personal experience, history, family stories, and we all see the world through this unique lens. The whiter, more Judeo-Christian, straighter, middle-class, educated we are, the more likely it is that we were told that how we see the world is actually the world, and how other people see the world is another unreal version of the world, that our view is the world. The thing that's hard, and the thing I think we make a mistake, even in my field in social work, we tell people that empathy is putting down that lens and picking up the lens of another person. I'm gonna pick up the lens of an Asian American student who's first generation immigrant who is, we can't put down the lens. The lens is soldered to our face. That's how we see the world. So how, if empathy requires perspective taking, how do we take the perspective of other people if the lens that we see the world through is soldered to us? The answer is you believe people's stories, you believe people's experiences as they tell them to you. You believe when people tell their story and say, this is my experience of what it was like to work there. This is my experience of what it was like to be a student there. This was my experience of what it was like to be called that. That you don't run that through your lens, you understand that the world that they see through their lens is as real and honest and truthful as the world that we see through our lens. And I think perspective taking, you know, there's four skills that ladder up to empathy: non-judgment, perspective taking, recognizing emotion, and communicating back emotion. If you can't perspective take, we can't practice empathy. Because the minute we say, oh, that's a terrible story, but that's not how I see it, it's okay to have an opinion, but you can't dismiss what people experience and talk about as truth. The last P is power. And we hate the word power. God, we hate the word power. We hate the word power. But let me give you a simple definition of power from Martin Luther King. Power is just the ability to affect change. And then let me tell you about powerlessness. As someone who's spent my entire career studying shame and fear, powerlessness is the most dangerous state that we can ever experience. It leads to violence, isolation, shame, self-harm. Power is just the ability to accept, to affect change. For somehow, we have come to the belief, not just in this country, because I work all over the world, that power is finite. That if I share some with Olivia and Genia, that's two pieces of a pie of eight. And now I only have 6/8 of that pie left. It's a zero-sum game. But that is not power. That is power over. And power over is finite, for sure. And I think what we're witnessing across the world today is power over's last stand. We are picturing really fearful, desperate people saying, I am afraid to move from a world of power over to power with and power to shared power, a belief in power that's infinite, a belief that power doesn't run out. It's not zero sum. There is no evidence anywhere that power over is effective, because when we lead and when we act, and even when we parent from a position of power over, we by definition disempower people who have great experiences, ideas, and stories to bring to the table. And so if we want to change, if we're tired of this story of white supremacy, and I'm going to use that word, and I understand, even my friends and family are like, I'm with you, Brené, can you not use that word? The only other time I've had people respond to language like that in my life is when I started researching shame, and people said, God, Brené, can you not use that word? Can you say embarrassment? Can you say, no, I can't. I'm going to say shame, because shame cannot stand being spoken. When you talk about shame, when you wrap words around it, it loses its power. The same is true of white supremacy. My job is not to make myself or anyone else comfortable. My job is to use the language that reflects most accurately what we're experiencing. And it is white supremacy. It is the belief that in biological, emotional, and cognitive ways that white people are better than black people. Very specifically, and it's gone on to, you know, you can extrapolate it now against, you know, a lot of other minority cultures. But here's the thing. We have dehumanized African Americans in this country. We had to. You cannot buy, trade, sell, and beat people if you keep them in the realm of human. You can't do it because we're not hardwired for it. We are actually hardwired to not hurt each other. And so in order to actually have something like slavery work, you have to rip the humanity out from people and see them as less than human. And that is not a million years ago. That is in recent history. And so our work right now is to call it what it is, say the words, figure out what we can do differently, and start to work around privilege, around power, and around perspective taking to believe people's stories and experiences. I am completely imperfect at it. And let me tell you, if you talk about it, you are inviting a shitstorm, because you will not do it perfectly. And some people will use your imperfection in trying to have real conversations as a weapon. That's okay, because to opt out of the conversation because you can't do it perfectly is the definition of privilege. To wake up this morning and say, you know what, I'm not gonna think about Charlottesville, I'm not gonna think about these things, I'm not gonna talk about them because they're so uncomfortable, it's such a downer, I'm really gonna spend more time looking at cupcakes on Pinterest, that is the definition of privilege. You can walk away from the conversation because you're not affected by it the minute you wake up, when you walk out the door, when you get to work, when you get to school. We have the courage to do this. We're going to have to do it together, and it's going to be imperfect. But if we don't do it, one of our worst stories in history will continue to own us, and it will not go away because pain will not be denied. So I think this is just a call to have braver conversations and to be more honest about the role we play, and to listen, and to also stop being so hurtful and shaming when people are trying. I understand, I get really tired of trying to explain my experiences as a woman to men. At some point I'm like, screw it, I don't want to explain, you figure it out yourself. But to what end? To what? I don't think that works. So let me take some questions. Anything interesting that we need to answer?
A lot of comments.
I'm sure they're all interesting.
Everyone's like taking it in right now.
Yes.
It was a shame question, right?
Yeah. Do you want to read that one?
Yeah.
I have a question for you about shame. We're shaming the white men who participated in the march. You say that we shouldn't shame others. I'm trying to wrap my head around when it's okay and when it's not. Can you talk about that?
So we're shaming the white men who showed up in Charlottesville, and I'm trying to learn more about shame. Is it okay to use it sometimes, and is it okay not to use it other times? No, it's not. It's not ever okay to me. There are two things. And this is where, like, you can call this Facebook how to piss off everybody, but I'm just going to tell you what I think. I don't think shaming anyone is ever good, and I don't think dehumanizing. So when I see people calling the men who are marching in Charlottesville white trash, I am adamantly opposed to that. When I hear people calling police officers pigs, I'm adamantly opposed to that. Why? Because every time we dehumanize someone, the very process that brought us to this place in the United States around white supremacy, every time we dehumanize someone, it rips a little piece of our soul apart. And dehumanizing the enemy, quote unquote, or shaming the enemy, is like wanting to hurt people so you put poison in the water supply. Like, you're gonna have to drink that water too. Shaming, dehumanizing are not social justice techniques. They're emotional offloading. What we should do is spend our time and energy holding those people accountable. What we should do is, if you're armed and you're a member of a white terrorist group, you shouldn't be able to get on a frickin' plane and fly home. We use shame out of desperation when accountability is not working. We need to put more effort into accountability. But I am not for the dehumanization of any person, regardless of who you are, because it's not effective. There's a movement right now to call out these people and name them. Is that shaming them? No, it's not shaming them. It's holding them accountable. I don't think it's shaming them. Shaming someone and calling them out would be, if they're hiding something, if you're not out yet, if you're a lesbian woman, you're not out yet, and I find out and I out you, that's shaming, because that wasn't my story to tell. These people had a story to tell. They went out. They weren't wearing hoods. They were kind of wearing invisible hoods. But they're dangerous. Having them on some kind of watch list makes sense to me, because it looked like domestic terrorism to me. Let's not forget about Heather. Let's not forget about someone was killed in this, and there are still people injured. So I think that's accountability. But shaming and name calling, I'm not for it ever. And we're getting used to it, and it makes our culture incredibly dangerous. Anything else?
How do you start this conversation in a school?
How do you start this conversation in a school environment?
Thank you.
With some container building is where you start. Meaning, in clinical work, we call it container building, where we kind of set up, we're going to have some uncomfortable conversations. What does everyone need to feel safe? What does everyone need to contribute? What's off, what's okay, and what's not okay? Just put it on the board, put it on a white, a big post-it paper on a whiteboard, whatever. Here's what's okay in this conversation. So the first thing you need to do is make sure it feels safe. One thing I will tell you is, the greatest casualty of trauma is vulnerability. And so when people experience trauma around race, around sexism, around poverty on a daily basis, being vulnerable around those topics and conversations is very difficult, because trauma teaches us vulnerability is dangerous. So you really have to create a safe environment to have the conversations, and then you just jump in and let people use their own language and hold people accountable to the container rules.
Anything else?
What is the best way to offer harsh reflection around privilege when somebody is mansplaining or expressing subtle racism or sexism without shaming? I often find people respond to the reflection without shame, and I am not sure if that qualifies as shaming or holding accountable.
That's like the $60 million question, or whatever that, what was that game show? $60,000
question?
$100,000 question. I think I was confusing it with the $6 million man, but... age revealed. So the question is, how do I confront someone about their privilege when they're kind of explaining things to me or being subtly racist without shaming them. And so it's really hard because one of the biggest barriers to acknowledgement of privilege is shame. So shame is not a motivator for better behavior. Shame ignites two things: rationalization, blame. And so I think it has to be, I think we have to say to people, listen, I feel like what you're saying to me is hurtful, and I don't feel like it's your intention to be hurtful, and I want to tell you how it feels for me. I want to have a conversation because I really appreciate you reaching out around this, but can I tell you how this is feeling for me? And then when you tell them, then say, it's not over there. Then say, how is it feeling for you? Well, I feel like an asshole, and I regret even talking to you about it. Okay, so what conversation do we need to keep having so that we're both grateful that this happened and it was hard and uncomfortable? Look, make no mistake. I have seen in the last couple of years political correctness used as a weapon of shame as much as I've seen it used as a tool for inclusivity. There's a story in Braving the Wilderness, my new book, about that a guy tells about going home to visit his dad. And he gets home and he has this really hard relationship with his dad as it is. And he drives, I think, from LA to, I don't know where he's going, but he gets there and he's like, how are the new neighbors, trying to make small talk with his dad? And his dad says, oh, they're great. We love them. They've come over for dinner a couple times. We're going over dinner to their house next week. Your mom's super excited because they're Oriental and they're making pot stickers. And the son goes, Oriental? Jesus, Dad, racist much? Oriental? There's no place called the Orient, Dad. And he just lays into his dad. And it ends up with his dad crying and saying, I don't know what I did or failed to do as a father. I don't know why you hate me so much. I'm sorry I'm an asshole, but I can't stay and talk to you about this right now because I'm driving my neighbor that I'm supposed to hate so much to cataract surgery, so I've got to go. And here's the thing. Oriental, not good language, not inclusive, not thoughtful, not mindful. It could have easily gone, wow, God, dim sum, with pot stickers, that sounds really great. Hey, I want to give you a heads up. Oriental is not a word people are using anymore. I know it's tough as things change all the time, but I know you care about people, so I know you'd care about that. Completely different conversation. And at some point, we do get to the point where we're kind of like, fuck it. Oh, well, there you go. We do get to that point. Everyone here is like, oh my God, everyone watching, look. If you're surprised that came out of my mouth, you don't know me. But we get to the point where we really are. We're like, screw it. I am not going to have that kind of conversation anymore. I'm not going to say, hey, Dad, look, this is the way. I'm tired of it. I'm exhausted. Why do I have to explain why you're hurting me? Because what is the alternative? What is the alternative? Is the alternative we stay, we keep pulling people who are drowning out of the river one by one, and we can't get them all, we just lose some? Or we go to the head of the river, to the mouth of the river, and say, where is this pain coming from? Where is this coming from? I'm willing to have the conversation. And let me tell you, I've said stuff too that was completely out of line. Because I didn't know. I mean, I'm looking at my friend Michonne. Like, I write about this in Braving the Wilderness too. I wrote a story about, I was giving a talk and I used the term gypped. And I was like, hey, I felt so gypped about that. And this woman came up to me like an hour after I said it at break in tears and saying, I loved you. You changed my life. You meant everything to me. And I'm so devastated that you're an anti-Semite. You're a fraud. I mean, just like this whole thing. And I was like, what is happening? And I'll tell you the whole story. She said, I just can't believe you said gypped. And I'm like, she could tell. I was like, I still don't know. She goes, how do you think you spell that? And of course, the only thing I could think of was Jif peanut butter at the time, of course, because I'm in a shame storm, that's my remedy. So I'm like, J-I-P-P-E-D. And I'll never forget, because she's screaming at this point. Nothing in the world is spelled J-I-P-P-E-D. It's G-Y-P-P-E-D, gypped. It's an anti-Semitic remark, you know, stereotyping gypsies. And I was like, in my mind, I was thinking, am I in one of those moments where I have a deep hatred for gypsies and I didn't know it and it's just coming out now? And then I'm like, shit. I was in a complete shame storm. And then I'm like, I actually didn't know. I had no idea. And if she would have come up and said, hey, I read all your books, your work changed my life, it saved my marriage, which are things she already said, and you said this word, I'm guessing you don't know what it meant, a little hypothesis of generosity. I would have felt grateful, not ashamed. So I don't think shame ever helps. Last question?
Yes, we have two more. When one is overwhelmed by this and wants to stay and be in the conversation yet feels paralyzed, what do you recommend? How does one fuel up?
When you want to stay in the conversation but you feel overwhelmed and paralyzed, look, you can't live in this conversation. We need everyday moments of our life. We need joy. We need gratitude. We need love. We need belonging. We need those things fortify us for this fight. And so what I would say is when you're feeling overwhelmed, take a break. And not from the conversation. Once you understand what's happening in the world, it's not like our break is going back to pretending it's not happening. But it's taking care of ourselves. You don't know how many activists I know who have burnt themselves out so completely that they can't be a part of the movement anymore because they don't have the will to show up. Look, we are fighting for civil rights, we're fighting for equality, we're fighting for justice, but we're also fighting so that people have access to the most meaningful experiences in life, love, belonging, joy, purpose. And if we don't have those in our hearts, we can't fight for other people to have them. So, and here's what I'll say about anger. There's this, there's a couple things about anger. People get uncomfortable with anger and they're like, why are you so pissed off? Why are you so hostile? Why are you so angry? That's usually code, that's shame code for you're making me uncomfortable. And I get it all the time. Olivia and Genia will help me, but they'll be like, by the time this is over, there'll be death threats against me or my family. There'll be, hey, stick to writing. There'll be all kinds of comments on here. My job is not to make people comfortable. Your job is not to make people comfortable. But my job is to take care of myself so I can stay engaged in hard conversations. So you need to practice self-care. You need to be angry when you're angry, but also know that anger as an emotion, great catalyst, terrible lifetime companion. Great catalyst. Be angry, but turn it into something else, because just to live with anger serves no one. It is a catalyst emotion. You have to do something with it. Otherwise, it turns into bitterness and resentment and illness, real illness. Last question?
A lot of different versions of, like, what are the next steps?
What are the next steps? Okay. So I think the next steps are, think about the P's, the privilege, power, perspective taking. And look, it's gonna take 2 million individual acts of courage to start changing this. We just need a critical mass. Luckily, there are millions and millions of us doing it. No one person's gonna flip this thing over. It's as much as how you show up in every day. If you're in HR and you're going through resumes, and you see a name that's traditionally African American or Latino, or you see, and someone kind of skips over it, call attention to it. If you hear someone dehumanizing someone, if you hear the term illegal alien, have a flag go up that says, wow, are we dehumanizing this person so we can get away with treating them less than human? Ask questions. Everyone's looking for the next thing to do. You know, reach out to your politicians and talk about what you need and what you expect. But this is a movement we are the movement. And this is how we show up in our lives every day, the smallest moments. This is about when your child is sitting down watching TV and you're watching a show and you're like, wow, no one on that show looks like your friend Mariana. I wonder what that means. Like, it's about raising consciousness and doing it through questions and curiosity and love. And then speaking out when you see something go wrong. And if you approach speaking out with anger and self-righteousness, you will not move people. You have to reach out with love and curiosity. But you also have to, and this is a chapter which I'm sure everyone will love, in Braving the Wilderness, which is speak truth to bullshit, but also be civil while you're doing it. So say, I don't believe that how you're framing that argument is real. I'd love to have a real, an honest conversation around it if we can be respectful. It's every day. It's just take it and weave it through your life, and it's who we become and what we do every day. So thanks for giving me time. I know it's been a lot. I do want to say something really quickly, and I'll probably do another Facebook Live about this, so it's at the top. I love our page. I love our community. It's a place for conversation and debate and dialogue and disagreement. But if you're shitty, I'm going to ban you from the page. And I'm not going to look back when I do that, because it's my page, and you can do